subject of spiritual endurance tonight. So I'm just going to look at the first three verses of chapter 12, Hebrews chapter 12. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. There are many things in our lives that take endurance. I'm sure you can think of many. I was coming up with some ideas myself, and I thought maybe aerobics or some other sport that you might enjoy takes endurance. Men going shopping at the weekend, that can take endurance. Bringing up children, that can definitely take endurance when they're younger and you're chasing them around the house. Saturday night comes and you're pleased they're in bed. Following a football team who goes down a couple of divisions can take endurance, as some of you know. Studying for exams or your driver's license. Working. Payday seems a long way off in January, but it's here finally. You know, it takes endurance working through the winter months. So here we're told by the writer to the Hebrews that as Christians running this race of faith, we need endurance to run this race. So a bit of background about this letter, who wrote it, well, we don't know. Maybe Paul, maybe a close associate of Paul. He was writing to these Hebrew Christians who are based in Jerusalem. And this was before the temple was destroyed. And there were lots of Jews who were actually ridiculing the Jewish Christians, saying, you know, where is your temple? Where is your high priest? Where are the priest's, you know, clothes? Where's the sacrifices? Where are your things that bring you close to God? And he's writing here to show that in the first 10 chapters how Jesus has been the perfect high priest. He's not only the high priest, he's also the sacrifice, all bundled into one. And now he comes on and he says, you need to have this endurance to continue running the race. God has started the work in you. You need to continue. So in chapter 10, verse 13, 1 to 3, continues to explain how they and how we, as modern day Christians, should continue living based on Christ's saving work. Robert Vaughan, the new actor in Coronation Street, when asked why he had joined the cast of Coronation Street, said that he'd rather be in a national institution than in a mental institution. And as modern day Christians, we can sometimes be looked upon as though we should be in a mental institution. You know, you believe in the literal six-day creation. You believe in a God you can't see. You believe these things. You go to church. You know, people might say, we're a little bit mental. Well, God is explaining in this passage that we have to show endurance in the face of opposition, persecution. And we're going to look this evening at three A's. We're going to look at the aim of the Christian life, this race. We're going to look at the approach we take. And then we're going to look at the assistance that we can have running this race. So first of all, the aim. Well, we've been given the aim in verse 1. Run the race with endurance. The NIV helpfully says, run the race with perseverance. So both of these show a patient but an active attitude. If you look at the mission statements of some of the companies that we use day to day, they tell us what the company does. So Diageo, the drinks manufacturer, they say, we make lips smile. Disney, to make people happy. Pepsi's mission statement is to beat Coke, unsurprisingly. Levi Strauss, we will clothe the world. What about Otis, the lift company? Their mission is to rise unnoticed. I thought that was quite clever. So if you ask the average person on the street what their mission statement in life is, what is it? Is it to be rich, get enough money to next payday, pay the bills, be happy, have a happy family? Well, what's the mission statement of us as Christians? Well, we're given it here, to run this race with endurance. Many of you might know the origins of the Olympic Games back in 700-800 BC, when the Greeks believed that their gods lived on Mount Olympus, and two of the gods once had a race, and at the end of the race one of them won and was given a laurel wreath, and that's where the Olympic Games was deemed to start. And the Greeks continued this, and they invented their own games, and it was a very simple affair originally. It wasn't like it is now, it was just a couple of short sprints. But as time went on, and when the writer was writing this, they probably had, you know, an annual games or every 2 years, and there was a longer race that they'd have been thinking of. This was probably a 5 kilometre race, probably the last race in the Olympic Games. So these people would have been very familiar with this idea of running a race with endurance. This is what these Olympic athletes did. And these athletes would have had to train probably for 12 months before they actually went into the race. And if you're an old man, you weren't allowed to participate. You had to be a young man. You had to be very healthy, very fit, and you had to prove that you were very talented at running to get into these races. So we see that we're to run the race. And I think there's an encouragement here. You know, it doesn't say we're to win the race. We're to run the race. I don't know if you used to take part in school cross countries or other races at school. I was always somewhere near the back. You know, people used to be coming back the other way by the time I was going out. But, you know, this shows a level of intent and a level of training that we are to run the race. We've read in the previous chapter, we don't need to read it now, but there's the Hall of Fame that you probably know about, this long list of believers who'd shown faith in their lives. We're given examples like Noah, who believed that it would rain, even though the world hadn't seen rain. So this is our mission statement, that we're to run with endurance. Thomas Watson, who's a Puritan, said it's sweating work all the way to glory. This isn't a list of jobs or tasks, but it's a race of faith. It's following, it's believing, it's trusting an invisible God in spite, often, of obstacles that we might come across in life. I've read in the paper this week, they do an extract in the Evening Standard about Olympic competitors, and this one is Mark Hunter, who's training to be in the rowing. He says, You know, a training camp's hard when at the end of the day, watching a World War II documentary seems like light relief. I wasn't particularly interested in history at school, but I've really got into it on the National Geographic Channel while in Portugal. To be fair, there's not much else to do here. We're in the middle of nowhere and we're here to train. 3 sessions a day. It's high intensity stuff. I'll do 2 hours on the water, an hour on the ergo, I think that's the machine, and over an hour in the gym on weights. The rest of the time is spent resting. When it comes to meal times, everyone just eats, barely saying a word, and then go to bed. Literally, it's all about surviving. So you can hear an Olympic athlete these days talking about how hard it is to train. And as Christians, we need to be ready to train and to run this race, this Christian life, as hard as these Olympics do, as hard as these Olympic competitors do. But we must remember that God himself is the one who preserves us. He's the one who preserves us behind the scenes. So although we're running, we continue believing, trusting, loving, working, both in bad weather and good weather, but we remember that God is upholding us. So that's the aim, to run this race with endurance. So what's the approach? Well, we're given that a bit further on in verse 2 of chapter 12. Sorry, just in verse 1. We're to lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. The NIV says, we're to throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles us. So it's not just talking about ensnaring us, but entangling us. John Owen says that sin is always at our elbow. If you think about it, going back to this cross-country example, as you were running, you'd get caught in brambles and your mud would get thicker and thicker on your shoes, your feet would get heavier and heavier. As the race progressed, so often it became harder. You had to work harder at it. So how are we to run this race? Well, we're to throw off the things that hinder us and we're to throw off the sins that entangle us. So if you think about Usain Bolt, he's on the TV at the moment in the Virgin Media adverts. There he is, all nicely toned, with his thin singlet on and light trainers. He's not wearing much at all. And often the Olympic athletes in these days would have been running naked, so you couldn't have thrown off more clothes than that. So the Amish community, just looking at a real extreme there in America, they some of them, they have very strong sects, like, I can't remember, one of them don't have hot water, they won't have electricity in the house, you know, they won't have anything electric in, you know, their work. So, for example, they do everything by hand. Well, it's not saying going that far, but we do need to be careful. It's not just sin that we need to look at in our lives, but it's other things that might be hobbies that can draw us away from God. I read in the paper this week, someone said that they must be a very responsible person because their wife had said they're very responsible. Because whenever anything goes wrong, they're always responsible for it. In James, in his letter, he says that God isn't responsible for our sin. We're responsible for our own sin. We're drawn away by our own lusts, and then when our lusts are fulfilled, then we sin. So we can't blame God for our sin. It is our sin. We read about a football coach in the United States called Irk Russell. He arranged for a couple of good old country boys to burst into a routine team meeting and throw a writhing, hissing, 6-foot-long rattlesnake onto a table in front of the squad. Everyone screamed and scattered, Russell recalls. I told them, when cocaine comes into the room, you're not ready as often to leave as when this rattlesnake comes in, but they will both kill you. And it's true that sin is as powerful as a rattlesnake. It gets into your life and it will kill you if you're not careful. Paul's advice to Timothy is watch your life and doctrine closely. Persevere in them, because if you do, you will both save yourself and your hearers. We're reminded that faith begins the work of salvation in our lives. So, I think if we're looking at how we can lay off this sin, how we can stop it entangling us, we can look at just look a bit more closely at sin and what it is. It's often said that we should know our enemies if we're to defeat them. Well, there's something I read about a shark tonic. It says it isn't a serum that prevents shark attacks or a medicine given to sharks. The actual term is tonic immobility, described as a natural state of paralysis that animals enter. Sharks can be placed in a tonic immobility by turning them upside down. The shark remains in this state of paralysis for an average of 15 minutes. I wouldn't encourage anyone to try that next time they're swimming off the coast of Australia, but that's how you render a shark, you know, safe for 15 minutes. Well, how can we render sin safe? Well, I don't think you can render it safe, but it's good to understand how it's so powerful and how it has a hold over us. Well, sin has great power. We've got to remember that our flesh, that means our emotions and our bodies, is still a fallen body. In Galatians 5:17, Paul writes, the flesh wars against the spirit. So sin entangles us because it's basically part of our body. It's our desires. Also, it entangles us because it's very close. We read that it's actually in us. So wherever we go, we're taking it with us. Jeremiah 13:23 reads, can the leopard change its spots? Jeremiah 13:23. Can the Ethiopian change his skin, or the leopard its spots? So basically, it's in our nature, and we have to beware of it. In Ephesians 4:22, we read that the old man, which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lusts. So it's the old man, but it's still near us, and it can still entangle us. So we are to disentangle ourselves from something that is present, it's powerful, and it's pervasive. But it's the Spirit's power that allows us to overcome this sin. We read in Psalm 119, verse 11, David writes, your word have I hidden in my heart, that I might not sin against you. We're to look to Jesus, who's at the end of the race, who's run it, and by his Holy Spirit, he'll give us the power to overcome this sin. But also, we have a responsibility. I read somewhere that bad habits are like a comfy bed. They're easy to get into, but hard to get out of. And I think good habits are probably the opposite then. They're like an uncomfy bed. Hard to get into, but easy to get out of. So we need to develop good habits as Christians as well. That will help us. So we've seen the aim, that's to run the race with endurance. We've seen the approach, that we're to lay off sin, hindrances, and we're to run looking to Jesus. And then we can see that finally there's some assistance that we can get from this passage that shows us how we can continue running this race. Well, anyone who watched Match of the Day at the weekend will have heard Mick McCarthy, who's the manager of Wolves, at the end of the match, having lost to Aston Villa. He said that it had been a bad match. They'd had a penalty against them, they'd been played off the pitch, sent off and carried off. And that was his reason why they lost. Well, if a football match goes well, it's normally because the players are assisting each other, they're passing, they're helping each other. And, you know, we are given advice in this passage, you know, where we can go to for assistance in running this race of endurance. Firstly, we can look to Jesus' example. We see that verse 2, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So he endured the cross and he despised the shame. If you think about, we looked a few weeks ago at the example of Simon of Cyrene, who carried the lighter end of the cross when Jesus was going up to be crucified. But we looked before that at all of the suffering that Jesus endured. You know, the betrayal of Judas, the unjust trial, the isolation, the torture in prayer, and the desertion at the hour when he needed his disciples most by his closest. Then we looked at the mocking of the soldiers, the crowds, even his own people, the Pharisees, who wanted him dead. We read that he came to pay a debt he didn't owe because we owed a debt we couldn't pay. So we can look at this example of Jesus, who endured all of this going up to the cross, and we should endure persecution ourselves if we need to, or trials. But it wasn't just that he endured the cross. You know, he was looking to the joy set before him. He was looking to being reunited with his Father in heaven. He knew that he would gain more than he lost. We read, I think, in his responses to the Jews in the Sanhedrin, what he was thinking. If we look in Luke chapter 22 and verse 67, we can see something of what was on Jesus' mind at that time. The chief priests and scribes said to him, "If you are the Christ, tell us." But he said to them, "If I tell you, you will by no means believe. And if I ask you, you will by no means answer me or let me go." And then you think he's going to start talking. Jesus will now talk about how he was tempted in the wilderness, or how he turned water into wine, or he'll talk about the many miracles he's done. But what does he say? No, he says, "Hereafter the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God." Jesus himself is looking forward to this amazing achievement that he will render when he hangs on the cross those 3 hours, when he suffers the Father's wrath. And when he achieves all of this, he knows that God the Father himself will raise him, glorify him, sit him at the right hand, and he will have accomplished what he came to achieve. So Jesus, even here, is showing us what he was looking forward to. And we too, as we run the race, can look forward and take this example that Jesus himself was looking forward to everything that he would achieve, and we can look forward and see that God has achieved it all for us. The second assistance is the witness of the saints. We read about this in Hebrews. It's not a mist or just a few, but we see there's a whole cloud of those who've gone before us. Now, as you came in this evening, I'd said to you, sitting down tonight, we'd be looking at a drunk, a liar, a deceiver, a murderer, a prostitute, and an adulterer. You'd probably think you're coming to the wrong building. But here we've got a list of all these heroes, these gold medal winners from the past: Noah, Abraham, Jacob, Moses, Rahab, and David. They've all been on this racetrack that we're on now, and they've all completed it, and they were gold medal winners because they were heroes, made heroes by God and Jesus himself. They encourage us, put your faith in God the Messiah. God is faithful. in the previous chapter, we read that Enoch walked with God, he pleased God. Caleb, he followed the Lord all his life. Esther, she said, if I perish, I perish, when she went before King Xerxes. Joseph, he gives instructions about his body. Noah, he preached righteousness. Moses, he refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh. And Jacob, he worshipped leaning on his staff. I always think that's amazing, that one. What's that there for? But must be there for something. So we can inquire of these witnesses if we line them up. We'd say to Noah, so in the matters of mission and faithful service, he'd say God is faithful. Joseph, in the matters of persecution and victimization, he'd say God is faithful. To Abraham, in matters of family planning, matters of relocation, moving home, he'd say God is faithful. To Isaac, we'd say in matters of family relationship, he'd say yes, God is faithful. Jacob, we'd say to him, in matters of employment, he'd say yes, God is faithful. In Moses, David, we'd say matters of leadership, they'd say yes, God is faithful. To Moses, we'd say, what about matters of wealth and poverty? He'd say, yes, God is faithful. To Gideon, what about matters when you're faced with opposition and there's only a few of you? He'd say, yes, God is faithful. And then to the martyrs, we'd say, what about matters of life and death? And they'd say, yes, God is faithful. So all these witnesses who've gone before speak through the words of Scripture. Practically, all these things that we face day in, day out, employment, kids, families, God is faithful in each of these things. So finally, what's the final assistance we can get from this passage? Well, it might not be actually in this passage, but we're taught two doctrines in Scripture, the preservation and the perseverance of the saints. And down through the ages, people have argued as to which came first or which is the most important. The Arminians hold to the preservation, to the perseverance, but not the preservation. The Calvinists maybe focus on the preservation. But they're two sister doctrines and they go together. We're told in the book of Peter 1 that we are elect according to the foreknowledge of God the Father. So we're preserved. God has called us to be his children and he will keep us. And then Peter goes on to say, you're kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. So we're being kept. So that's the perseverance underlying the whole of this. So we're in this race, we're on the racetrack, and we're running. But God is holding us by the hand. As we finish, I'll just finish with an example, an illustration. You may have heard the story of John Stephen Akwari, the marathon runner from Tanzania who finished last at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. That would have been me if I'd been doing it. No last place finisher in a marathon ever finished quite so last. Injured along the way, he hobbled into the stadium with his leg bloodied and bandaged. It was more than an hour after the rest of the runners had completed the race. Only a few spectators were left in the stands when Akwari finally crossed the finish line. When asked why he continued to run despite the pain, Akwari replied, "My country did not send me to Mexico City to start the race. They sent me here to finish." And that should be our attitude as we read these passages through Scripture about perseverance, that we're here to run the race and we're here to finish the race. This race that's been set before us. And by God's grace, we will run and we will finish this race of faith.